And KPCW News Time is now 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Well, let's find out what we've got in store for our weather today. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday. We're going to be looking at the midst of that summertime heat wave really peaking as we go throughout today. So, yes, get ready for another very warm afternoon across the area. Lots of sunshine with that high-pressure ridge right overhead. That's going to lead to highs climbing into the mid-70s for us in the Park City area. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your weekend, you guessed it, that heat dome will stick around, at least heading into the weekend. So that means your Saturday, more of the same, near record heat expected. Highs will be back in the mid-70s again for your Saturday afternoon in Park City. Highs will be in the low 80s for us in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Sunday, we will start to track some minor changes. We've got a front that's going to be coming through the area. It's going to come through dry. May bring us a few high clouds, but that would be about it. Otherwise, we will bring a little bit of a wind shift, which should help to knock temperatures down back just a little bit. So instead of looking at highs in the mid-70s like on Saturday, we'll be looking at highs only in the low 60s on Sunday in Park City. And we'll be looking at highs only around 70 in the Heber Valley. So instead of 20 to 30 degrees above average, more like 10 to 20 degrees above average for this time of the year. Now, as we go into the next week, we're going to be continuing with this warming trend once again. So we'll see those highs going back through the 60s and into the 70s by next Tuesday in Park City, and those highs warming back through the 70s and into the upper 70s near 80 by next Tuesday in the Heber Valley. Meanwhile, as we go throughout next week, it still looks to remain on the dry side with well above average temperatures. We may see a few little dips here and there, but overall, it looks hot and dry. Of course, the spring equinox is today, of course, officially at 8:46 in the morning. So just a few minutes away, we will officially be in spring, but we really almost jump right past winter and right on into the season of summer. And that'll stick around into most of next week. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, let's see what this weird weather means for the backcountry. On the phone, I have Bo with the Utah Avalanche Center with today's conditions. Morning, Bo.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me. Right now, avalanche conditions are in a quick transition into something we'd see more in late spring or early summer snowpack. We've issued a special avalanche bulletin for the mountains of northern Utah, central Utah, southern Utah, and even southeastern Idaho. Right now, overnight we didn't see temperatures drop below freezing, but we saw clear skies, and a little bit of breeze, and that helped freeze the snow surface, providing a short window of safe travel. As the daytime temperatures warm, people should be able to expect to trigger wet, loose avalanches. But the real thing we're looking for, and there's a lot of uncertainty around, is the potential for wet slab avalanches to occur. As daytime temperatures warm, we're going to see a lot of meltwater from the surface snow traveling down and through the snowpack. And that has the potential to pool on certain layers in the snowpack, particularly around crusts or layers of facets. And that could result in wet slab avalanches. These avalanches are very large, they're very destructive, and they have the potential to run far. So we've extended our hazard even to the low elevations because of the potential for these large avalanches to occur on mid and upper elevation slopes and have that debris run down into low elevations. Things are going to change. We're going to see temperatures start to cool off slightly on Sunday, and the potential will decrease a little bit. We could see the avalanche hazard come down on Sunday, and particularly into early next week with a chance for a dry, cold front that comes through. As always, people can tune in here on KPCW and listen to us, or check our website, utahavalanchecenter.org. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Bo, and have a great weekend. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, I'll be speaking with Wasatch County Emergency Manager Jeremy Hales. Then Park City Council Member Molly Miller will stop by with a debrief from last night's council meeting. We're going to finish our hour by chatting with Ted Morris about his time with U.S. Speed Skating. Stay tuned. Summit County leaders are lauding the plan to redevelop the Kimball Junction Outlet Mall as a model for the rest of the region. But after Dakota Pacific, it just might not get approved. KPCW's Connor Thomas explains.
The Summit County Council may have finally gotten a development proposal that it likes, redeveloping Junction Commons, but it could be the right project at the wrong time, since a new neighborhood is going in right next door and traffic is top of mind. Councilmember Roger Armstrong says there's a lesson to be learned in that.
If the legislature had not forced a Dakota Pacific project, which is essentially what happened, I would be actually very, very excited about this. I think it's a great vision. It's a great layout. It's a good plan.
Dakota Pacific Real Estate's development is adjacent to the upper loop of outlet stores in Junction Commons. In total, Dakota Pacific will build 885 units of housing, plus new businesses. Outlet mall owner Singerman Real Estate proposes cutting back its own commercial square footage slightly by replacing the upper loop with housing and filling the lower parking lot with mixed-use buildings. The design, sometimes called infill housing, is what appeals to council members like Megan McKenna, as opposed to development in a vacant field.
This entire area could really serve as a model, not only for the county, but for some of our cities.
Armstrong says it's the kind of redevelopment he'd welcome in parking lots around Redstone across 224 to the east, which he called a design disaster. Junction Commons could be the first successful rezone to the neighborhood mixed-use zone the county created in 2021, but rezones require a council vote, and that gives the council broad discretion to approve or deny it. The last time council members voted to approve a new project was in December 2025. That was the controversial Dakota Pacific development, a passing vote that council members said was cast under duress from state legislators. There was public uproar, a referendum effort to overturn the vote, and a lawsuit. And traffic was one of the anti-Dakota Pacific movement's driving factors, says Councilmember Canis Hart.
And that this would be another project on top of that. And for the life of me, I can't figure out how we're going to deal with all the traffic and the cars.
Junction Commons' proposed housing is a mix of apartments and townhomes, 510 units in total, and the vast majority would be replacing the upper loop of stores. Usually, the NMU-1 zone requires half the housing to be affordable, but local laws allow the council to decide to require up to 25% fewer affordable units if they're the ones that get built first. Council members want to see details on the affordability of the project and its traffic study the next time it meets with the developer. Singerman has touted how it will offer more options besides car transportation, including Summit Bike Share. The vision is to make the outlets themselves more walkable, and there would be trail connections to Dakota Pacific's neighborhood to the south. Summit County and Junction Commons are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Wasatch County will be holding an emergency preparedness fair tomorrow. Here to help us prepare for it is Jeremy Hales, the Wasatch County Emergency Manager. Good morning, Jeremy.
Yes, good morning. How are you today?
Jeremy, thanks for joining us. So, Jeremy, let's start with the basics. When and where will this fair be held, and can anyone attend?
It's open for anyone. Anybody can come and attend, and we encourage all folks to come. It's going to be at the Wasatch High School, located at 930 South 500 East, and it will begin at 9 a.m. and go through 1 p.m.
And is this the first time you've held a function like this? And why do you think something like this is important?
No, sir, this is not the first time. We've held it for several years. This is the sixth year, I believe, that we've held it together with the Self-Reliance Committee. But this is important because we want our citizens and our community members to be prepared in the event that we have a disaster that happens, whether it's man-made or natural. Our folks need to be prepared so they can withstand, you know, being without power, being without, you know, communications for a period of time, and they have the ability to do so. And this is what this is designed for, is to help prepare for disasters, whether we need to evacuate or our homes for wildfire or an earthquake or something of that nature. We need to be prepared for those types of circumstances that may arise.
You know, it is interesting, Jeremy, when you see a media coverage after some kind of natural or man-made disaster, the difference in what happens to people based on their degree of preparedness is remarkable. It really does make a difference, doesn't it?
It does. It does make a huge difference in the outcome. And so being prepared ourselves is the most important thing we can do. Us as citizens, individuals, we need to be prepared because that starts at home. It starts with us. And then it can grow to our neighborhoods, our cities, our towns, our counties, and the state. If we all do our part, we'll be more resilient and ready for the unthinkable that could possibly occur.
Yep. So tell us a little bit more about how the fair is structured. What will happen if I come there tomorrow?
So if you come there tomorrow, you're going to walk into the what's commonly known as the Wasatch Commons, and there's going to be tables set up or booths For different vendors that are going to be there. There's going to be folks from local government that are going to be there, from the county, cities, and towns. There'll be folks from that have preparedness supplies for you. There's going to be mental health help there for that type of thing. There's also going to be communications that are going to be there for emergency communications, and then our local utility companies will be there to help support us. But the neat thing about this is it's not just in that Commons area. We also have classes on gardening. We have classes on with the Red Cross. We're going to have a ham radio and communications class. There's stuff on becoming self-reliant, and it's going to be just an open discussion. Have talks on beekeeping and chickens as well, and how to raise them and do it a proper and right way.
No, it's really interesting because I looked at your website and downloaded the list of both presentations and displays. And so the range of topics that are covered, you know, certainly goes well beyond what you would think of as traditional preparedness. So you really are trying to, you know, give sort of a broad community education session tomorrow. What would you think are the sort of, if someone were to come there and really wants to get to core preparedness issues, what are some of the presentations you would advise them to attend?
Core presentations, you know, the gardening is a big thing, so you can prepare your food storage, I think, is a great big one. I think the ham radio communications is important. Red Cross is going to provide hands-on only CPR, which is a very important tool. And you know, and I think there's also a mental health product being class being taught that, you know, when we have disasters, the psychological effects of those are very real. And we need to make sure that our citizens remain calm, because it's going to take the first responder community is incredibly amazing as they all are. It's going to take them a minute to get to all of those folks. And so having their kits ready and those types of preparedness things in their home is very, very important.
You know, I noticed that someone named Alyssa Scherzinger is going to give a couple of really interesting presentations. One of them was called Preparing for Disaster in Your Community, and the title is The Neighborhood That Saved Itself. And another one was Planning for a Disaster, Don't Pack Your Fear, Pack Your Plan. Can you share a little bit about what those will cover? They sound like they would be pretty core.
They do sound really cool. This is the first time we've had Alyssa at our event, but it is about, you know, being calm when tragedy happens. It's about, you know, being ready, and then you can just calmly work through it. It makes it much more easy for us to deal with the problem and deal with the incident that's occurring when we're calm and we can effectively navigate the situation. That's a really good one. The Neighborhood That Saved Itself is all about working together as neighbors, is what I understand it. You know, I haven't spoken to her. Mm-hmm. We have a partnership with this youth, or the Wasatch Self-Reliance Club. And so Mike and Josie Peterson have been very helpful in helping that. And so this is an individual that Mike and Josie picked up. And so I appreciate that they're, you know, our partnership, because it's, you know, it's the local government that's helping, but it's also the community that's helping. It's not just one or the other. It's a combined effort. And that's what I think is really unique about our Wasatch Back presentation on emergency preparedness.
And I noticed that you are going to be hosting, I think it's a booth or a table, on the Civil Air Patrol. What's that?
So the Civil Air Patrol, so they reached out to us and they asked a little bit about how they can help with disasters. And so the Civil Air Patrol can help in a lot of ways. One of the ways they can help is with our public safety communications. In the event we have communications could potentially go down, which that's not saying that they will. Our communications are very robust in the public safety world, but they can get up in the air and provide us a link so that we can broadcast our signal to the other responders. They have a lot of great, you know, they can help with search and rescue. They can help get a bird's eye view of the disaster for our stakeholders, so that they have good situational awareness. So using the Civil Air Patrol is a great resource that we have, and it's just started here in Wasatch County, and we have a great group of auxiliary members that are just starting this program, and they're very, very eager to serve and make a difference in the Wasatch Back.
And I noticed that a lot of government agencies will also have booths. Can you share with the audience a little bit about what you would expect to be able to learn at some of those, you know, government agency booths like the Heber City Police, Wasatch County Search and Rescue, and Wasatch Fire?
So our Wasatch Search and Rescue, they're going to talk about, you know, things of safety in regards to our recreation safety, you know, and being able to plan for those things, making sure you wear your life jackets, you know, having that avalanche beacons and those types of things. Heber City Police will talk, will have presentations or stuff available for home hardening, and so will the sheriff's office. We'll also have some stuff about how you can contact 911 in the event that the 911 system goes down, or our phone system goes down, not the 911 system, the phone system goes down. Mm-hmm. The text to 911 capabilities that we have at every dispatch center across the state, we're going to share a little bit about that. Our detectives divisions are going to be out there from, as well as the patrol and corrections divisions are going to be there to talk about how they're being helped in self-reliance within their divisions and where they work out in the community. So really good work from all of our folks there. We're also going to have our community emergency response team there, as well as Heber Light and Power, talking about alternate powers. We'll have a solar presentation there, and then Enbridge, our gas company.
You know, Jeremy, we sort of touched a little bit on one of the sort of major potential disasters that we could face in our area, which would be wildfires. Is anyone going to be talking about sort of home hardening and things to do to sort of help limit the danger of wildfire at the home? Will the fire department be able to talk about that?
Yeah, the fire district will be there. They've been very proactive with that work going on with HB 48 and making sure that people are aware of home hardening. And just making sure that they do their part. This is a very important thing that we need to remember where we live in our homes and such are in the wildland urban interface, that we do have home hardening, you know, that we do protect, you know, we have stuff that's 5 feet out before we have vegetation, and just make sure we mitigate all those potential dangers for embers to come in and cause, you know, tragic events of losing structures. So it's important that we do that, and our fire district will be there to support that.
Okay, Jeremy, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
We just want all of you to come. We would love to have as many of you come and enjoy our time. You know, come sign up for our Everbridge 911, or excuse me, our Everbridge emergency communications software so that we can communicate with you in the event that there's a disaster. Wasatch County will only communicate with you with that tool only during emergent times. And so we're going to have all of that there available. And so just come say hi, come visit us. We'd love to see you, and can't wait to have this event tomorrow morning.
And again, this is tomorrow morning at the high school, at the Wasatch High School. What time does it start?
9 a.m.
All right, Jeremy, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Roger. Have a great day.
The Park City Museum has a new exhibit, Park City Loves a Parade. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the exhibit is part of a national celebration marking the United States' 250th birthday.
As visitors walk down a ramp to enter the Park City Loves a Parade exhibit, they may feel like they're participating in one of the town's famous parades. Band music plays, the walls are covered with large photos of crowds watching a procession, and a decorated fire truck sits just ahead. Curator of collections and exhibits Courtney Titus said the exhibit is 2.5 years in the making. Museums across the country have been preparing displays to mark the 250th anniversary of American independence. The Metropolitan Museum of Art has a showcase exploring the roots and outcomes of the American Revolution, while the Smithsonian Institution is hosting an exhibit called Our Shared Future 250, which asks Americans to commit to advancing democracy and preserving the future of the U.S. Titus said the Park City Museum was eager to participate in the national celebration, but wanted to tie it into local themes. Titus and the exhibit team, including Dalton Gackle, Morgan Pierce, and Sophie Krupp, landed on Park City parades, processions, and protests from past to present.
We decided to go with the idea of community coming together to support each other in times of joy, in times of sadness, in times of anger, indignation, no matter what is going on.
After the parade walk, visitors are greeted by a sculpture called The Frog Prince. It's a remake of the parade float of the same name by artist Zaphod Beetlebrox. Titus said anyone who's been to the 4th of July parade on Park City's Main Street would recognize the green metal frog with purple lips, wearing glasses, and a gold crown. The celebration section also features other Park City traditions, including the Halloween Dog Parade, the Olympic Homecoming Parade, and the Labor Day Parade, which locals call Miner's Day. The exhibit also features parades from Park City's history. For example, Parkites held a spontaneous parade after learning World War I had ended.
We tell the story of Victor Peterson, who was in the Navy and he was on leave, came home to Park City, and that's when everybody found out the news. So they hoisted him up on people's shoulders and paraded him down the streets.
Visitors can then move on to the section focused on moments of community mourning. Its displays describe the Daily West mine disaster, where the entire town mourned together.
There were funeral processions all day long for the miners who died in that explosion.
The town comes together to mourn national tragedies as well, including a procession after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The exhibit also recreates the Glenwood Cemetery entrance and features funerary objects from the museum's collection, including casket ornaments and mourning brooches. Finally, visitors can see how Parkites have come together to stand up for what they believe in. For example, the exhibit describes how locals protested when Vail Resorts applied to trademark the name Park City in 2016, and how locals, Sundance Film Festival attendees, and other Utahns protested the day after President Donald Trump's inauguration in 2017.
We talk about not just protests, but also strikes. Going back to our mining days, there were strikes that happened between the mine workers and the mine companies, fighting for better working conditions, better pay.
The exhibit also includes more recent strikes and protests, like the 2025 Park City Mountain Ski Patrol strike. Titus said she hopes locals and visitors will visit the exhibit to learn more about Park City's history, but also to feel a sense of belonging and community.
Even if people don't always agree, even if there are divisions, if people can find a way to come together and support each other, that'll get us through.
The exhibit will be open until March 2027. Titus said Spanish translations of the exhibit descriptions will soon be available as well. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Park City Council held a regular meeting last night. Here for the first time for a Friday morning debrief is a relatively new council member, Molly Miller. Good morning, Molly. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I think I'm still technically new.
Well, you're still technically new because you were just named to the council in February. And before we get started with this, I want to get a sense of what are your first impressions of life on the Park City Council?
I love it. I knew I was going to enjoy this work. I had that incredible experience with the Nonprofit Services Committee, which really was my first step into this arena. And as I kind of kept plugging away and, after coming in 7th out of 8 in the primary, I just kept feeling like there was more that I wanted to learn and do. So I joined the leadership class, Leadership 32, which has also been incredible. And then
you're not going to say it's the best class ever. No one ever comes on the air without saying that they were in the best class ever.
The best class ever. But Mayor Ryan kind of was heckling us about that at the leadership symposium. But I feel like this is for you, Mayor Ryan. Best class ever. At any rate, it's just been incredible. And I think the most amazing things for me have been the extent of the ability to connect with the community, obviously, is what I really got into it for. A bonus for me has been seeing what an incredible staff there is at City Hall, how invested they are in making sure that I have context and background and opportunities and resources. And if any given moment I email with questions, they are right there. Let's meet. Here's a meeting. We're going to work with your schedule. We're going to set something up. I've had dozens of meetings. I haven't just done the 2x2s that they set up for council to prep us for the meeting. I have just met with planning and housing and HR, and it is just like they are available for us to make sure that we have the information we need to make the best decisions possible. It's been astounding.
Is the entity more complicated than you thought it was from the outside?
Oh, certainly. And I think, I always had the knowledge that I don't know what I don't know. And working with the school district so many years ago really was a huge illuminating experience for me. A lot of things go on behind the scenes. And certainly there are so many reasons that sometimes things are happening and it just seems to be confounding to a resident such as myself, who I was sort of dialed in, not really a ton. I was a busy working mom and partner and volunteering here and there. So many things have clicked into place, even in just the short time that I've been able to serve.
And is that complexity, was that one of the things that's more surprising about your first weeks?
No.
Okay.
No, I knew that it was going to be a long learning curve.
Yep.
And I think one of the biggest priorities for me, in addition to viewing things through a lens of affordability and community, was maintaining an open mind and absorbing all the new information that I could.
And speaking of complexity, yesterday afternoon there was a discussion about the budget. Which I was following. First of all, anything significant to you from that discussion?
I asked a question about this. I think one of the most staggering things for me was how much money there is. And I had heard a little bit about it. Obviously, we had preparation meetings and some information that was shared, but we didn't have the full extent. And I knew that things had kind of been buffering. There'd been a few larger projects buffering over the last few years. But getting that full picture, and this was thanks to Mayor Ryan's guidance to the team to really show us what was possible, that was, I think, a little bit shocking for me. And understanding that we have so much capacity to improve the daily lives of residents in Park City was thrilling.
And can we take it down a level? There was a discussion about different kinds of capital expenditures and different ways you can budget versus bonding, recognizing that we only have a few minutes and this is a very complicated topic. Can you sort of characterize what that discussion was about from a reasonably high level?
Sure. So luckily you have an expert here. Just kidding. they explained it in a way, Eric and Penny, phenomenal explanation. And the question that they asked council, whether we were ready to move beyond what they called a pay-as-we-go and reevaluate every few months cycle, which I think in more of a crisis situation might be appropriate. They also asked whether we would support a long-term strategy to leverage financing tools to deliver legacy projects in the near future. That would be looking into bonding,
right,
looking into maximizing that money that we do have ready to deploy. So the result was that we chose to have them come up with a plan to really examine a conservative leverage of that money through bonding.
So some bonding for some major capital projects.
Yes.
And how will that play out in terms of, are there specific capital projects that somebody has in mind, and when will those come back to be presented?
Yes. So they were looking at all what they called programmed capital projects, and those were things that teams and council had asked for, suggested, things like the senior center, everything from pavement maintenance to the senior center to capital improvement projects. There were about 20 on their hypothetical list, and a huge part of the April and May council retreat and budget process is that we will create a framework of priorities. What are the things that we must do for health and safety? What are the things that we've been wanting to do for years, like that senior center? How can we come up with a strategy and a thoughtful way to leverage the funds that we have now with the bonds? We're not going to put any cart before the horse, certainly, but coming up with a plan to really accomplish some of these projects in the near future.
Okay. I want to ask about, there was an update, I think, about rapid transit, about the bus rapid transit. I think that was from High Valley. Tell us a little bit about what you learned and what we can expect in this ongoing process to change 224.
This was such a cool presentation. The High Valley team, I know it's like this simple thing, but they had these great colors and this really clear communication technique. I learned that we're getting into construction season. And so they really went through all of the pieces that will impact Park City traffic, and everything from the Box of Rocks to the McPollin Barn. They had these extensive notification plans. It's going to all begin on April 6th, that Monday, April 6th. There will be flyers. There will be texts. There will be emails. All these things notified. Signs on the road. All of this to start implementing the bus rapid transit.
And our listeners are all thinking, okay, what's that going to mean for me this summer in terms of traffic delays?
They are going to let you know before you go. Mm-hmm. They have this absolutely wild response time of less than 24 hours for any questions. They are going to practically put the information into your hands. All you're going to have to do is read it. So you want, I mean, holidays, they won't be doing construction. Those super, super busy days, you won't have to worry about that. Most days will be two lanes open each way for traffic. They have an incredible plan. It's all on
Is it accessible to, can they find it on the website?
Yes.
On the Park City
Yes,
Council
it's
website.
In our agenda.
Okay. Okay.
And also, like, they have these, just High Valley Transit, Google that. They have, you can just click and check out the schedule. They're super responsive.
And over time, there was a lot of discussion about where the widening would stop. Where did that land? Do you know what I'm referring to? It was a question of whether it would, you know, about widening 224 inside of the canyons or not.
Ah, yes. You know what? I will get the exact answer for you.
I know there was a back and forth on that.
Yes,
I just know what
and I know
was.
That the medians, in the middle, that was a, you know, but those will be replaced with the landscaping when that's done. That's removed at first, but they're coming back.
I think there were a lot of people in council chambers last night, and somehow I don't think they were there for the budget discussion.
No, it was Ed's birthday.
Okay, that's why they were there. So what they were really there for was the 3-acre or the property formerly known as the Arts and Culture District discussion. What was the agenda item?
The agenda item, exactly, let me look for you, discuss design and strategy preferences for the Bonanza 5-acre site redevelopment.
And this is an iterative process with the developer, so I take it what was being discussed last night was their latest plans.
Yes.
Before we get to what council did, there was a lot of public comment. Vibrant Room, talk to us a little bit about that.
Vibrant Room is exactly right, and it was, honestly, it was a thrill to see it so packed. I heard the staff before the meeting as I was reviewing and tabbing all my notes, and they were like, we're moving out the tables from the back and we're putting more chairs in. And you walked in and there was this great energy. And I don't think anyone had the same opinion on what should be done. I mean, variations on a theme, a couple of really creative ideas. I was so happy to hear every single one.
Okay, at one end, we had people who were advocating, you know, don't build it at all, make us a park. And at the other end, there were issues about, have there been the right balance between housing and arts and culture-related space? Talk a little bit about that issue, because I think that was sort of the big issue of the night at the end of the day, wasn't it?
Yes, and you know, it's like, I would love to be able to please every single one of the people in that room. I think what this was, I think Tana, council member Tolley, mentioned that it was the 36th design that she had seen, which was astounding. I was so happy to have that perspective. It really snapped it into focus for me. I think what we have here is the most beautiful, thoughtful, and strategic design that we've seen thus far. I like it. I think it offers an opportunity to create a magnet open space within this vibrant commercial residential zone. I don't know if we're ever going to achieve the perfect mix. All I know is, hey, we've taken a step forward. We are moving this project forward. We are not letting perfection get in the way of progress here.
It's kind of a complex equation. You got three factors going on. You got the degree of open space and arts and culture space. You've got the number of housing units, and you got the financeability, the practicality of the development. Obviously, if you don't have enough housing, to pay for it, it's going to be a problem.
Exactly.
And where are, again, without trying to put you on the spot, approximately how many units are in the current design?
The current design has 106 units. Okay. And our LIHTC funding would potentially come under threat, like meaning they may not approve the project or funding for the project should we go much below 100.
Right.
Yes, I know folks are worried about that density. Of course, we hear you.
And that, I think Tana was saying that at the end of the day, she talked at the end of the evening. I did not hear your end of the evening speech, but I caught part of hers. And she was saying, look, I think we're close, but maybe just push a little more toward arts, culture-related space and a little less housing. But I guess the issue is going to be, how far can you go without running up against that LIHTC problem?
Yes, exactly. And I just want to recognize Councilmember Tolley really quickly for the beautiful way that she handled the disagreement, her differing opinion. I thought it was a great example of how a really functional council can demonstrate different opinions. I think it's a really important thing. And I think it's healthy. And I was texting her this morning how much I respected what she did and how we handled it. We gave each other a hug at the end. It was fantastic. It's exactly how local government is supposed to go. I think that for me, affordable housing is such a critical priority for our community. And there are reasons why we have that 15% goal. I think that 106 units may seem dense, but I don't know if folks are familiar with the term internal capture, which is the data that shows that for every single residential unit we put in town, it removes two cars from those choked roadways.
And according to that, how many stories are the buildings?
Three stories.
Three stories now.
And there's one four-story building in this design, and it is outside the frontage protection zone. It was designed to comply with current code.
Okay, Molly, what comes next in this process?
Oh, so we voted, Ed motioned, I seconded, which I think was another awesome moment for our journey. And next it goes to the Planning Commission. So stay tuned, it's gonna be likely a few months of additional iterations. And the design will continue to grow and tweak, and we will make sure that arts and culture gets the space that it needs.
And I always ask council members this question when talking about this topic. What's the over-under for shovels in the ground? Date. Over-under.
Let me look really quickly. I do not want to give you the wrong information. Let me consult my
notes.
No one
ever knows the answer to that.
You ready?
Yes.
December 2027 to potentially break ground.
Okay. Molly Miller, thanks for spending time with us this morning. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. We'll be right back after this. A hotel stay in Wasatch County is now, on average, the most expensive in the state. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports that change is attributed to Deer Valley East Village.
Heber Valley Tourism Deputy Director Jessica Broadhead says it is getting pricier to visit Wasatch County.
Our average daily hotel room rate was $476.68, which is the highest average daily rate in the state.
She shared 2025 tourism numbers with the Heber City Council at a meeting March 17th. The price tag is increasing as Deer Valley East Village opens more high-end hotels and amenities. Historically, high average hotel costs in Wasatch County have been driven by the St. Regis Deer Valley. Midway's resorts also increase the average. Those properties have combined with the new East Village hotels to make staying the night, on average, about $65 more expensive in Wasatch County than in neighboring Summit County. Costs in the Wasatch Back far outstrip the rest of the state, according to data from the University of Utah's Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute. That study also shows average hotel costs rose 15% in Wasatch County from 2024 to 2025. Room rates went up in Summit County too, but only by about 4%. Although hotels are becoming more costly, the Gardner Institute report shows short-term rental rates are dropping across the Wasatch Back. And renting a condo or house in Summit County typically costs several hundred dollars more per night than renting a Wasatch County home. Broadhead says every year visitors bring millions of dollars to the county and support more than 2,000 local jobs.
17% of our local jobs, 25.4% local sales tax revenue, and 54.4 million visitor generated tax revenue. Tourism is a flourishing economy for Wasatch County, and we're quite proud of that.
To read more about Utah's latest travel and tourism data, visit kpcw.org. Heber Valley Tourism and Economic Development is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Ted Morris has been the executive director of U.S. Speed Skating since 2013, and he'll be stepping down as the executive director in August. He joins us to discuss his long sliding career. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's talk a little bit about the career path that you went through. What led you? What is that career path that led you to U.S. Speed Skating?
Well, I first worked in advertising in New York City and then came out
to... Who'd you work for?
BBDO.
BBDO. When I was a practicing lawyer, they were one of my biggest clients.
All right. All right. I bet you they were well paying.
They were.
But I worked there in New York, and I worked on Visa, and one thing led to another, and I got a job working for the U.S. ski team and came out here in 1999. And so I've been in the Olympic world for a long time and went to an agency after ski team. I left in 2010. And from there, was recruited to the job as executive director of U.S. Speed Skating.
So let's talk about the organization when you first walked in that front door. What was it like?
It was a bit of a mess. You know, I saw it as a great buy low, sell high opportunity.
Okay.
And it worked out that well, that way. There was a lot going on. I think the biggest problem they had, which is one that a lot of Olympic sports have, is that they're volunteer-driven instead of professionally driven. And that's what we really changed over the course of my tenure there, is we became a professionally led organization with a great board of directors, but they weren't telling us how many pencils we could order each year. And I think that's a good recipe for success for any nonprofit.
And for those who haven't really thought about it, tell us about the scope of what that organization, what ideally that organization does. What are the scope of the activities?
Well, at our core, it's pretty simple. Win Olympic medals and grow the sport. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot that goes into that.
I was going to say, that may be some of the outputs. What are the inputs to that?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, development. It's grassroots. It's getting more kids skating. It's providing high-performance services that allow our athletes to succeed. And the biggest challenge we have, as a lot of Olympic, Winter Olympic sports have in this country, is there's no high school or college speed skating. So how do we get kids to commit to becoming an Olympian and maybe winning an Olympic medals when they're 18 years old, they're graduating from high school, they probably have great collegiate opportunities? Are they going to come out here to Utah and dedicate the next 8 years to become an Olympian? Or are they going to go get an education and start their careers?
And can they do both?
It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah.
It really is. And the bigger problem is, even if they're doing something job-wise, it's taking away from their training because we don't want them on their feet. They're staying up late, all those kind of things. So it is tricky to do both. Though we have really worked hard at establishing good educational resources with Salt Lake Community College, who you guys have had in here to talk to them about what they're doing to help Olympic athletes get education.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. As you just said, you know, there are collegiate ski teams and organized ski programs that sort of make it a little bit easier for a program like the U.S. Ski Team to identify potential athletes. But there's not high school speed skating. Are you recruiting hockey players? Who are you recruiting and how do you identify them?
Well, we do have a club system. So we have about 65 clubs across the country, including, of course, Park City here, which has produced Casey Dawson, two-time Olympic medalist now. And so we have about 65 of those clubs across the country. And actually, this weekend is our age group national championships in Boston. So we have age group events. So we're seeing talent come up the pipeline. And then when they get to a certain level, we also field a junior world championship team. So athletes qualify to make that team. So mm-hmm. we start to see the athletes develop. And then we, at that point, we invite them to come out to Salt Lake City to become a part of our national team once they hit a certain level.
So when they hit a certain level and they're invited to the national team, what does that program look like for them?
It's really, I mean, that's another piece of what we've really tried to professionalize. Because we know we have to compete with the same thing colleges are doing when they recruit athletes and what they're providing their athletes. So we have robust services and support, obviously coaching, medical, nutrition, you know, everything that any college would support their athletes with, we have there too, including we built the Speed Factory in my tenure down there, which is similar to the Center of Excellence here in Park City, which gives off-ice training to our athletes, which is on par with any collegiate facility in the world.
And a young athlete who you are hoping to be an Olympian in 2 years, what's their day like?
It's a lot of work. You know, it starts early. They usually have two ice sessions. They'll have a weight training session as well. They're obviously getting worked on by the medical team. They come at 8 o'clock in the morning and they leave at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It is full time. And so, you know, just like any other sport and the way that sport has become in this country and this world, you got to put the hours in.
And are you able to provide them with some financial support or some of them?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And obviously they have very limited costs. We pay for all the coaching right. and the travel and all that kind of thing. And then they get a stipend.
They do get a stipend.
Yeah. But only the top ones. Right. And it's not a lot. Right. And I mean, you know, it's such disparity between the top athletes. Jordan Stoll's just won 2 gold medals. You know, he's being taken care of. But then you go down and you look at an Ethan Seperon, who was part of that Team Pursuit team. You know, they're not making a lot of extra money from sponsorship.
And we talked a little bit about sort of where the money goes. It goes into building a training facility. It goes into stipends. It goes into paying the coaches. Where's it come from? Talk about what was development like when you got there and how did it change during your tenure?
Yeah, no, we obviously that was my background was sponsorship and marketing. And then I learned a lot about fundraising at the U.S. ski team, seeing what they did. And that's the two areas that we really invested in and made huge gains. And so we have, because we only have about 2,000 members, so we don't have membership revenue. When I came in, about 70% of our revenue was from the U.S. Olympic Committee.
Wow, okay.
That number now is below 40%.
Okay.
So we've really changed that by increasing our fundraising and sponsorship.
So you've done fundraising. Have you changed sort of the media relationships as well?
Absolutely. Okay. You know, big effort there on outreach and making sure that we're in the news as much as possible. Another big thing that we did in my tenure is we really went to this Olympic trials model. So we've had an Olympic trials every 4 years, and that's done a great job of exposing our athletes to a broader audience through the coverage we get on NBC networks there.
Let's talk about this year's Olympics. How did you feel about the performance of the team?
It's a roller coaster ride. Man, it is tough. You know, on the plane ride home, I felt fantastic. 6 medals, you know.
Yeah,
and
6 medals.
That's the best we've done in a long time. And the second most of any U.S., other than ski and snowboard, of any NGB. So that felt really good. Same time, 4 fourths. Yeah. And nothing is worse.
It is the worst thing in the Olympics. There could be nothing worse, I'm sure.
It is heartbreaking. 4 of them. And a lot of them really close, too. But when you look at it in totality, feel very good. You know, the best feeling about what we do in sport is when you're standing there and your athlete's on the top step of the podium mm-hmm. and the flag goes up and the anthem is played. And there's just not a better feeling in the world. And that's why, you know, I think these jobs are the best. Those moments are worth all the hard work.
And how many of those athletes are young enough so that they might be back next time?
We're in pretty good shape there.
I was going to say, I thought they were pretty young.
Yeah, Jordan Stoll's is 21 years old. Yeah. So it's crazy to think that technically his prime will be in Salt Lake City at, you know, 28, 29 years old. Casey Dawson is still only 25 years old. And as a distance skater, he'll only be 33 in Salt Lake City, you know, if they choose to stick around. So those are two athletes to point to. But in general, we got a really young team. So I'm very bullish about the future of U.S. speed skating.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking about what an interesting life choice it would be for someone to spend their entire 20s being in the gym all day, working for the U.S. ski team, but a speed skating team. But these people love it. I mean, otherwise they couldn't do it, I assume.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's this great opportunity to represent your country, and there's nothing like that other than, you know, what our military does for us. So it's really special.
So what are you most proud of from your tenure?
I think I'm probably most proud about the transition we made from this amateur organization to a professional organization. On top of that, you know, when I took over, we were $1 million in debt, and now we're $1 million to the plus. So I think financial stability, governance stability, putting our athletes in a better place to succeed, those are probably the 3 things that I'm most proud of.
Okay. You're getting out in August. What are you going to do next?
Well, as you know, I'm a volunteer DJ here at KPCW.
Fabulous way to spend your time.
So hopefully I can pick up a few more shifts. Maybe become, the second Roger Goldman at some point. Who knows? But we'll see. You know, I think my career started focused on the 2002 Olympics. I was lucky enough to be here for those. And I certainly want to be involved at some level in 2034 and the Olympics here. So I know I will continue in the Olympic space. It's just to what degree.
Okay. Not going to pick up another full-time job, I take it.
Who knows? We'll see.
All right. Ted Morris, stepping down as the executive director of U.S. Speed Skating. Ted, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Roger.
We'll be right back after this. Well, coming up, we'll have the community campfire. So gather around the community campfire this morning. We're going to have a podcast that features the voice of our community here in the Wasatch Back. We're going to hear a hilarious story from Karen Stone. She's a Park City Toastmaster. We'll also kick off a series devoted to the folks who help share our kids' lives, teachers, with sixth grade science teacher Christina Hooksema. And our music sesh features Mike Rogers with an in-studio performance. Also, we'll have Skinny on Sports. Also, we want to thank everyone in the community for making our winter pledge drive a huge success. If you requested a thank you gift when you made your pledge, please come visit us to pick it up. That's either Tuesday, March 24th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., or Wednesday, March 25th, 2:30 to 6.